So today we're going to talk about confidentiality. We're going to look at the Mark Ziegler piece and review HIPAA, which you're all familiar with, and then look at the most famous confidentiality case, which is the case of Tarasoff. Before we do that, though, I want to make sure that we are all on the same page about the game plan with the written assignment. So let me repeat it here so that everybody has the maximum amount of time to understand what the plan is going to be. So before the week of the 27th and 29th lectures, class time, everyone will get their paper back whether they handed it in late or not, their outline. So the last week of class, the last week of November's class, everyone will have the paper back if you've already done the outline for me. Everyone will have it back whether you handed it in on time or not. And having the outline in hand, you will have a bunch of pluses and minuses on it that say that the argument is working, thumbs up, or the argument does not work, thumbs down, which would be a negative. And then we're going to bring those outlines together with our laptops, and you're going to put your track changes on, and we're going to divvy up into groups of five or six people, and you're going to work together as I walk around the room, tweaking the outlines with my assessment of which arguments work and which don't. You're going to assess your outline, you're going to tweak and revise your outlines right then and there in class, so that by the end of the first hour, you have worked on the outlines with the wisdom of the group, and then by the second hour, any repair of the arguments you don't think you have fully in hand, you'll bring to the whole group, where we will use the collective wisdom to see what else needs to be done to strengthen any arguments you think are still weak in the paper. The reason this is going to work is because there aren't going to be 90 different arguments that are at play. As you know from the alphabet soup we talked about, there is a very finite set of arguments, and there is a very finite set of possible objections and re-rebuttals to that finite set. So even if you have an argument that isn't repaired after your group work that I'll come around with, you can grab me and I'll just keep mulling around helping to repair the arguments in the small groups. If you are not satisfied with the way that your argument has been repaired and somebody else is not is concerned about the way that that argument is not repaired, the chances are very good that there are only going to be five or six arguments left that need repair, and together we will work on those. And so if you do this in track changes, you'll print out the track change outline for me when you hand in the paper, and by the end of the day of that week, your outline should be ready to go. Because the work that you and I would have done in my office hour is exactly the same work that you will do first in the mini group, and if you're not satisfied with what you're getting there, you'll bring to the whole class. There aren't that many arguments that will be in play, and so everyone will have their arguments tweaked, and together we'll work on what is the bar, where does the bar get set for meeting objections of opponents and responding to them. And that's how we're going to accommodate the fact that, or the problem we had with the hurricane taking a full week out of the semester. So online now is the updated syllabus, and also an article that I gave out last week, which is a wonderful example of an argument made by Zeke Emanuel and a rebuttal argument made by the second year medical school and Scientific American medical student on this very question of PAS, so you can actually see in live time what the contemporary arguments and debates are. And I think that it's a very nice set. If you are defending the anti-PAS position, you will be thinking, how do I, and you used any of the arguments that are at play between those two pieces, you'll be thinking, how do I defend the Emanuel position against the rebuttal from the medical student? If, on the other hand, you are pro-PAS, you will look to see how well the medical student did against the tough arguments of the opponent, Zeke, who is anti-PAS. So I think it's going to give you a nice example in addition to all of the work we did. And the bottom line here is that, again, philosophy is not a whodunit. You can't cheat, because basically what you're trying to do is learn where that bar is. And so what you'll do is bring any concerns you have to first to the small groups and then to the larger group, so that you're actually learning in real time as opposed to on your own. And to me, you'll get to the exact same place. Everyone succeeds in this class. So that was already written in the stars. It was already in the fabric of how we're doing this. So that'll still happen. It's just going to happen in a different format. Questions and concerns?
Do you have copies of the papers that you got?
They're online now. They're posted. And if you can't find them, let me know.
Okay.
There were stacks and stacks of them, but apparently not now.
Okay.
So, but they are definitely up online. And if you have any trouble, just let me know.
Okay.
How about any other questions? Concerned. Yeah.
So we'll just get our outlines back at the beginning of that class?
I am hoping before that, but now that I feel like there's no option but to do all of them, now there's 100.
Clear.
And so I have this week, and then I've got a couple of days next week before you all leave. So if I had all next week, I would surely be able to get it to you back by the end of next week. But we're losing, every time we turn around, we're losing days. So we're losing Thursday and Friday next week. Even if I have them done, you're nowhere to be found. So what I can say is they will be back the Monday of Thanksgiving. And if it's inconvenient, if you want to see the paper beforehand, I mean, again, you're not going to get any grade. You're just going to have plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, 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 plus. You know, it's not going to, you're not going to see much because all you're trying to do is just repair arguments that don't work. Once you've got all pluses, you have an A. If you've got all minuses, you're going to have to repair quite a few arguments. If you only have one or two minuses, there's hardly anything to repair. So that's what you're going to learn from this. So what is really important is that you have it with you the day that we go over it, whether that's the Tuesday the 27th or the Thursday the 29th. Having it much in advance doesn't really matter because we're all going to work as a collective to turn all those minuses into pluses. So it's not the end of the world if actually you don't pick it up before you walk into class. It doesn't actually matter. But if it is something that you want back on that Monday, assuming I can't get it done before everybody leaves on Wednesday, because this is our big problem, a lot of you will be MIA by the last time I see you a week from tomorrow, and that may not be realistic for how many there are, then you could ask on Monday for Olivia to scan it to you, and she could scan it to you. Again, I think there's no stakes in having it in advance of this class, because the work is going to be, remember, I'm not even recording what happens on those outlines. It's not like, oh, well, I'll have to I'm just handing them back. There's no grades on them. So there's nothing that except to say, all right, I've got three that I have to repair tonight, or I've got one, or I've got four. So if you don't have them back, I think it's very low stakes. If you want them back and you don't have the ability to come in because you don't come in this way, you can get it scanned. So I think that's how we'll work out to meet everybody's needs. Again, I think what's important to note, though, is there's nothing at stake in not having it prior to this session, because this is where we're going to do the work to get those all into pluses. And there is no curve, so if everybody, as is usually the case, gets an A or an A minus, so be it. You know, it's not like Princeton where they say, no, we're going to, there's been a movement at Princeton to try to get a bell curve distribution again into the grading. We don't have that. We're all about grade inflation. So there's not going to be anything to worry about. Other questions?
I just want to confirm that we don't have class at all next week.
We do. Oh, no, we don't.
We don't.
We don't. We don't. So then I don't even see you next week. So the prospects that you're going to have them, it's even if I've got them graded, I don't know how you're going to get them. Right. And the good news is, I don't see why you need them.
As you go along, are things looking good?
I'm so small into the pile, because what happened was once there was a hurricane, all the things that were supposed to get done in the hurricane week didn't get done. So I don't know why, but we're in this nightmarish try to catch up. So I have no idea. What I can say is that it doesn't actually matter how they look, because at the end of the day, they all get repaired. And if the more, as long as people understand what went wrong with the minus and how do you turn it into a plus, it doesn't matter when you learned how to do an argument that was a plus. As long as at the end of the day, you made an argument that was a plus. It's not like the SATs, where if you take them twice, your final score gets discounted by the fact that you didn't get it right the first time. It doesn't work like this. So an argument that's solid is an argument that's solid whenever it became solid. And that's what I think is important to remember. Once you nail it, you've nailed it. Who cares if you didn't nail it first?
A little bit of pride, shame.
Oh, but only you would know that, right? So, right. Right. Alrighty. Any other concerns and questions? All right. Where is everybody? What is going on? When it was the election, I kind of understood. But now I'm like, what is this? So crazy. Okay. There's deep and depressing meaning in it, but we won't go there. All right, this is what we're going to do at first. We're going to talk about Mark Ziegler, who runs the Chicago Ethics Program. University of Chicago has a very famous clinical ethics fellowship program. He's been a past president of the American Society of Bioethics and Humanities. He's been in the field for a very long time. And he's written a piece called Confidentiality as a Decrepit Concept. And we want to think about the argument that he's made, first, that confidentiality is not a viable concept, that it doesn't do the work that it's supposed to do. It doesn't mean what it's promised to mean. And then we want to look at his argument for why he thinks that there are conflicting interests, that moral interests, moral reasons, moral considerations that make it impossible to achieve confidentiality for the universal, for all patients, even if we didn't have any mistakes in what kind of information got inadvertently leaked to the wrong people or in inappropriate settings. What do I mean by that? Well, we will talk in a few minutes later in the class about HIPAA. HIPAA was not designed to address much of what Ziegler's concerned about. It was designed to, because Ziegler's already presupposing that information that gets passed back and forth about the patient is actually legitimately passed back and forth. HIPAA is concerned about information that is not legitimately being passed around, that is not on a necessary basis, that is being leaked, or that is gossip, or that is being shared with non-medical personnel. Ziegler is much more concerned with information that is being shared inside those individuals who are trying to deliver care, and trying to deliver care for the patient's benefit, as opposed to HIPAA, which is more concerned with how information can be leaked that's to no benefit at all, and it's pernicious. So when we get to HIPAA, we will not be really thinking about HIPAA as a way to repair the kind of gaps in confidentiality, because Ziegler is working on a whole different kind of problem, and maybe one much more insurmountable, we'll see. And then finally, we'll get to the most famous confidentiality case. We'll get there in a minute. Okay. Ziegler is worried that this concept is decrepit, and he illustrates that by starting off with the scenario of what does it look like to have information that you consider to be your own private information and be in an institutional setting like a hospital. What is the first opening conundrum that Ziegler wants us to look at when it comes to confidentiality? Why is your own personal information and your concern about informational privacy, that's what confidentiality is, it's a species of privacy, a kind of information-based privacy. Why, just out of the starting gate, is this so difficult to achieve in a hospital? What's the image that he conjures up, or the scenario that makes us realize how very difficult it is to actually make good on our commitment to patients to keep their information confidential?
He mentions that he calculates something like 75 right. people have to be in the chart in order to give the patient the proper care.
Okay.
So those people have to communicate with one another, and therefore your privacy as such is broken, because otherwise you can't have it both ways. You can't have care without conversation.
Okay. So in our hyper-specialization, where individual specialties and various domains of the different interdisciplinary approach to care, from various nursing professionals on staff around the clock and throughout the week, IV nurses versus this type of nursing, various specialists from pulmonologists to critical care to nephrologists, then you bring in nutrition support and who knows what. You got all these different people who are bringing a different type of expertise to the table. And when you get all that together to deliver outstanding care, you are really talking about your information being spread far and wide among the full set of providers and the treating team. So that's the scenario he starts with. And then to help us understand a little bit more of the ethics that are involved, he takes us to two dichotomies. where he says that we, as either in the micro level of as the individual or at the macro level as the society, have various moral interests, various concerns about how we meet the needs of patients specifically or patients more broadly that are actually in conflict with each other when it comes to our value of protecting patient privacy and private information. And so he thinks about two dichotomies, and I want us to work through both of those and see if he's right that confidentiality has to be betrayed in the way that it's betrayed because it's in the interests of the various parties to have information shared. So let's start with the first dichotomy, which is a conflict between the patient's care, the good of the patient, and the good of the society. So what you might think of as confidentiality being in conflict between the individual and the public good. So let's start with the question of how is it the case that sometimes the kind of information that the individual might want protected and have good reason to want protected might fly in the face of the needs of the public and the needs of the public to have that individual's privacy betrayed or revealed. So how is it the case that we could have a need on the individual level to protect somebody's confidentiality and the need at the level of the macro to protect the public's interest, a need to actually betray that confidentiality or to reveal that private information? Because one of the things Ziegler wants us to do is see that unlike once we get into the discussion of HIPAA and some of the times when HIPAA comes into play where it's not actually in anybody's benefit, it's not to anyone's good, lots of the betrayal of confidentiality or the revealing of private information actually is for this good as opposed to that good and vice versa. So give me an example where the patient might have an interest in having his or her information protected, but the good of the society, the public good, demands that something be revealed.
Sexually transmitted diseases.
All right. So one of the hotbed issues would be the STD. Okay. Give me some others, and we'll work through them individually. What else? Where else would individual information about that the individual has be needed to be known by the public?
Well, if you're a convicted child molester or diagnosed child molester, you might
okay.
on the list, and people have
okay.
the right to know that.
All right. It's not healthcare, but
but it's to a degree because you have to be diagnosed as well as convicted, right? Or no? Am I thinking?
I don't know. I think that child molester might just be that you have been arrested for it. So, but let's bracket it. I mean, it's possible. If there's a diagnosis, then it would be more in this arena than if it's actually just a criminal situation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no.
Okay, what else? What other instances do patients' individual information get shared with?
Well, any instance where there's, like, research going on for something or they're trying to research. I mean, it could be true with, like, HIV or something. They're trying to collect information. They're trying
okay.
to, like, get data.
Now, if they're just doing research, they tend to have non-identifiers on it. Okay. So while the information, there was a patient with such and such,
right.
It tends to be de-identified. Where else will you see the revealing of your private information where you are identifiable? Possibly.
Health insurance?
That's true, but it isn't for the good of society. That's sort of like a you and your insurance. Where else do we see patients' private medical information being shared with at least some others besides STDs?
How about mental health issues? Maybe bipolar disorders or schizophrenia?
Well, in the kind of Tarasov case, where there's a mental illness that actually is a palpable, credible threat, we can talk about that. You can't, HIPAA protects any information about my mental illness or any illnesses that I'm facing that don't pose a public threat, but if they somehow pose a particular public threat, Tarasov is the ruling that will help us understand that better. There are more obvious ones than that.
you're diagnosed with MRSA in the household, we're going to have a sign out front.
Okay, great. Great. What else? What's the big one in college? Great.
It's all sorts of infectious diseases. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. All right. So we have enough on there, I think, to get the conversation going about when and in what with what parameters information that is your private information could be shared with others. Let's start first with the meningitis case, because the dichotomy, I think, works quite differently for a case like meningitis than it will work for something like an STD, of which there are many, but two notable ones will be HIV and, let's say, any of the others like, you know, chlamydia or gonorrhea. They function fairly differently in the law, so we'll want to treat them differently. But let's think about this dichotomy. I have an interest, the idea from Ziegler, I've got an interest in my medical information being private, but you, the public, have, in some circumstance, an interest in actually knowing about my medical information. So let's start here. Let's imagine that I have meningitis. What is the protocol? How does the healthcare system deal with the fact that I have meningitis? What do they do in terms of protecting the public good?
Well, you're isolated.
Okay, so first of all, I'm isolated, but that doesn't necessarily betray my private information. What do they do that betrays my confidentiality?
They contact people that may have been exposed to you.
Okay, and it's fairly constrained. So the thing about meningitis is, if you were just sitting in class together, you are not going to be a victim of meningitis from each other. That you actually have to have much closer contact than that, not just casual contact, but fairly significant contact. So they want to know, were you the person's roommate? Were you involved with that person? Not just, did you happen to pass by in the cafeteria? And yes, they do find those people out so that they can give them prophylaxis. So that they don't come down with meningitis. So they actually need to know it is Autumn, and here are the people that Autumn has interacted with, and if Autumn's not capable of saying who she's interacted with, they do an investigation and say, look, Autumn's had meningitis, you know, I want you to know that, and they actually will reveal that to you and go investigate. True. How do people feel who have meningitis about the idea that their private medical information is being shared with the people that they were in close contact with? What do you think the range of responses is to the fact that that's my information, it's being shared with some constrained members of the public? If there was an article in the DP, it would be, there was a case of meningitis, they wouldn't put my name on it. They're actually hunting down just those people that could be affected, so they don't announce it to the whole world, they announce it to people I have close contact with. What do you think the response is of this dichotomy of, I want my information protected, but the public, some members of the public need it? What do you think?
I think mostly people are relieved that others aren't, they're not going to be the cause of another's suffering.
Okay, I think that's right. I think when it comes to something like meningitis,
there's no shame in that.
Right. Right, and that's the crux of it. That's the crux of it. So when we talk about this dichotomy between the private person's good and the public good, the private person can put oneself very easily into the public good's perspective on this and say, of course you should go contact my roommates. They don't want anyone to get meningitis or tuberculosis, or if you were one of the first people to get H1N1, because there was nothing you could possibly have done to avoid meningitis or H1N1 or tuberculosis. You just happened to be sitting on a bus and somebody coughed and done. And so this dichotomy is a little bit overly generic, I think, that Ziegler draws, because the patient, I think, sometimes in these kinds of circumstances, is actually not in conflict with the public. The patient is on board, and so doesn't see this breach of confidentiality as actually a conflict between what I want and what the public wants. Because what I want is, in this case, for the public to be protected, because I would want that information, and nobody's at fault here, just rolled the dice badly, and so I'm not actually in conflict. So most people, I think, are fairly comfortable with the information given out to the public who needs it, that I have meningitis. Most people are not, don't consider that sacred information. But when it comes to something like STDs, it's another level. So talk to me about the response that people might have about and their justification for really finding this to be quite a conflict between what the patient wants kept confidential and what the public should have a right to know. And in fact, does the public have a right to know? Is this, in the case of STDs, is Ziegler right, where we all agree that the public has absolute right to information about these kind of contagious diseases that people just encountered, but that could be lethal or devastating for others? Everybody's on board that there's really not a conflict of any really palpable nature because we're all on board, but when it comes to STDs, there truly is a conflict. Can you talk to me about why does the medical profession believe that confidentiality is legitimately violated when it comes to STDs? And which STDs? What do you think?
Well, are you making an argument that there's like levels, like circles of here the patient's at the center and there's certain people that do have the right to know and others that may have the right to know and others that have no right to know?
I wasn't thinking in that sense, but I think that's one question we could ask. Who actually has the right to know about Autumn's gonorrhea? And when we talk about the right to know, we must be talking about the right to be given that information, even if Autumn's not the one giving it.
But if Autumn has gonorrhea and she knows it, wouldn't you have gotten it treated and you no longer have gonorrhea?
Well, so this is, while I'm getting treatment, what do you do about the fact that I got it from somebody and may have given it to somebody? What do you do, even if I've gotten treated, what do you do about the people that may have encountered me, that either gave it to me, and so obviously had it at least at some point, or what do you do about the people that I might have given it to before I was treated? So the question is, do those people have a right to know, and from whom do they have the right to know it?
Do have the right to know, and it seems really murky how you go about that, but I mean, in general, in the way it is now, it's up to the individual. The healthcare system doesn't call partners and notify.
That is certainly true on HIV. Is that still true in chlamydia and gonorrhea? Because they are reportable to the public health department. They have mandatory reporting, at least they did.
It's reported to the CDC.
But no, to the CDC, but not to the local department, the public health department.
I think it might depend on state to state.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Because I know that in Massachusetts they'll call you, like from the public health department.
Right.
They'll notify potential partners and say, like, you may have been exposed to chlamydia.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they don't do that here.
Yeah.
So Philadelphia may be in a bubble of protection. Mm-hmm. It is certainly fairly widespread in states that, at least in the past, mm-hmm. that they did. Now, let's imagine. Let's just go with our, since we don't have the list of where you do and where you don't, we do know that some states will actually ask you for the partners that you've been with, and then they will call them. And we know that other places do not. And we know that in some diseases, for example, in HIV, there was almost universal non-disclosure. So whereas with chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, there was at least at a certain point almost universal disclosure. Let's talk about that distinction first. Why was there almost universal disclosure about gonorrhea, syphilis, and chlamydia, and almost universal non-disclosure to partners, potential partners with HIV/AIDS?
They're treatable.
You would think, but that isn't it. Because it, you know, it is true that at this point, those other diseases can be treated, and early in the HIV/AIDS crisis, before AZT, there really wasn't anything, except that a lot of the laws about non-disclosure were solidified post AZT.
Well, because people would lose their jobs. A lot of stuff like that? Like just the fear and the stigma?
Yeah. So what explains the difference in the way that the public health system dealt with these diseases was entirely based on how the lobby and the advocates for the various diseases worked to protect patients with particular diseases. So the argument was that in order to protect the patients from the stigma of a disease that could be how devastating it is physically, it could be devastating to someone in terms of their job or their insurance status or being able to be allowed to go to school, laws were created to protect patients with HIV. So it wasn't that HIV wasn't more severe, because obviously at the time, it was early on, it was a death sentence. Now it's chronically managed. It's still, many people may die of it, but it is very much in a lot of ways chronically managed, and yet that distinction was really drawn politically, not medically. Okay, but that does lead us, I think, to ask at least what the moral obligations are for the good of the public. That is, how much justification was there from the beginning? You're arguing, for example, that that I have a right to know that somebody that I've had sexual relations with has sexually transmitted disease. Then, and your question was, but I'm not sure how that person is supposed to find out. I'm not sure what the...
Who's responsible
for telling them. Right, exactly. Let's find out, what would the argument be that there is no public... Let's just find out if there's an argument in the group, whether this is something you hold or you don't hold. Can you think of an argument for why it is not it is not the medical profession's job to tell potential partners that they might be exposed to a disease? What's the argument that you could give for saying that it is not an obligation? That in fact one ought not to look for partners? I mean, you're saying that in Philadelphia they don't even do it, so somebody must have an argument. They do it in one place and they don't do it in another. Somebody must have an argument for why it ought not to be done. And then we can look and see, well, why do people argue that it ought to be done, and we can compare them. Because the question here is the good of society in knowing this, at least members of the public, so paramount that somebody's patient confidentiality ought to be violated without their will?
I think the argument against it is that you potentially put people in dangerous situations.
Okay, so one argument could be that you put them in danger. What kind of liability or repercussion could there be to me if she tells you you were exposed?
Well, I might beat you up.
Okay, so I might be at risk of physical violence. Probably more likely if you are the man and I am the woman, or we're both men. Maybe if we're both women, but if I'm the man and you're the woman and you're finding out that I am the one with chlamydia, I'm not sure. I mean, it could be.
Depends
on what kind of weapon I think you're going to bring to bear. True. But yes, there could be some physical, for sure. There are circumstances where you could think of where somebody would be in bodily harm. Okay? What else? What other kinds of harm?
Well, you could also argue that if somebody's, I'm not sure if this fits exactly, but where you could argue that it's somebody's, each individual's responsibility.
Okay, now that's a separate argument.
Sorry.
That's the argument for why you have no obligation to tell.
Okay.
First, we're trying to figure out what kind of harm could come to me if you disclose information about me to someone else. And I could get beaten up, that's true. What else could happen?
You can get sued.
All right, maybe I could get sued, right? Exactly, for exposure to something. Okay, what else?
You could have to live with the guilt.
All right, so you might wound me psychologically, you might wound the relationships. You might permanently injure the relationships that I have. Okay. What other kind of harms could come to the patient? Relationships, I could be physically hurt, I could be psychologically overwhelmed with guilt.
I mean, the person that's notified might tell other people.
All right. I might have that all kinds of rumors or my reputation, or not that it's so bad to have an STD, but I just mean, you know, this, it can be shaming and humiliating. So that's another kind of psychological kind of assault or emotional assault. Okay. All right. So that's the question of what kind of harms could come to the person whose confidentiality is revealed. Some might argue, yes, but those are the costs that person has to pay to protect the person who was the receiving end of an illness that maybe I passed on. But now you have an argument for why that's actually not that good an argument, or at least potentially one. Why should we worry less about the public, the other people who might have gotten an illness from me? What was your argument there?
I'm having a hard time following your wording. What I was saying was that there's like a greater good, that like if one person passes it on to another, like they should be able to know, because then they could go pass it on to someone else, and they could go pass it on to someone else, even just in terms of cost to society.
Okay.
Financial.
Let's talk about so that was a different argument. That was your first argument, and I was responding to your second.
Yeah.
So let me just note them. That's fine. So let me talk about the greater good of preventing infection. Let's put that down as a possible argument in favor. So we're trying to argue two things. We're trying to argue first, let's see if there's an argument that what are the arguments that are made to disclose private information, and what arguments are there to not disclose? On the not disclose arguments, we had first that harm could come to the person who's got the illness, and then you had mentioned another argument for why we shouldn't disclose, and it was about the responsibility of those people that I had relationships with to protect themselves. Tell me about that argument. Let me ask you this. It sounds like that we're having a hard time grappling with all these various moving pieces, and understandably so. If I said to you, I am a patient, yes, and I don't want you to tell anybody else that I have this illness, because it isn't like they are victimless in the way that they would have gotten it from me. In other words, is anybody confused about how you actually end up with an STD? And is it the case that knowing how you actually get an STD, that there isn't anything you could do about it to prevent it? What exactly could you do to prevent yourself from getting an STD? What actions could you take to prevent getting an STD?
You could make sure you do not have unprotected sex.
All right, so for one thing,
that doesn't fail.
Well, I think that, you know, of all the STDs in the world, after you take care of all of the ones that were sourced in unprotected sex, you wouldn't be left with a whole bunch of cases.
But your best intention may not be successful.
Okay. So there may be some times where you just couldn't protect yourself, and then I think it actually really is more in the case of like meningitis and some of these other diseases where you just kind of encounter them. But what I'm trying to get at is two things. First, you could not have sex at all, or you could have protected sex. And everybody seems to me to understand that those are the options that you have if you want to protect yourself fully from STDs.
Or you could educate yourself beforehand and force your partner to get tested.
All right. So you could either serosort, or you could have make sure that you all have a clean bill of health, and then you don't have to worry. Except for pregnancy, you don't. If you're having cross-sex relationships, then you don't have to worry about the diseases at all, because you could both be tested and everybody's clear. And those are the three ways. In other words, people who are proponents of non-disclosure will sometimes say, isn't it your obligation to protect yourself from me? Why is it that it is the interest of the medical profession? Why is the medical profession allowed to reveal my private information when you knew how to protect yourself and you took the risk you did? Right? So in other words, go ahead.
What about in the case of like a cheating spouse?
Okay. So cheating spouse may be one of those domains where the person who's having sex with you has has very legitimate grounds for believing that there is no need for protection because, let's imagine you have a monogamous relationship where you've committed to monogamy. I'm not supposed to have to worry that you're bringing me a disease because you committed to not having sex with anybody else and I don't have a disease. So you are, there's another layer of moral problem there. Namely, you told me you weren't having sex with somebody else and you were. So I think that is a different level of obligation, but it doesn't exactly expand how many people would be told. It would mean, is there a right for a spouse to know about another spouse having an STD? And that's another question. Inner spouse. But mostly when we're talking about the Public Health Department of Massachusetts calling people up, they are not usually limiting the calls to the spouse. So I think it's a special case that we should consider. But let's imagine that, you know, you're living your life and having sex with more than one person is the way that you're living your life, and the people that are having sex with you are living their life that they're having sex with more than one person in addition to you. Isn't there a kind of tacit understanding that when you're out there in a non-monogamous, you know, vowed-bound relationship, that you are taking some risk? I'm asking, I'm throwing this out to the group, because what I want to do is question whether our assumptions about when confidentiality ought to be revealed really are grounded in good argument, or whether they're grounded in prudery, or a bias towards monogamy, or a certain understanding of how sexual relationships should happen, or, like, I'm wondering, are we making good decisions here when we reveal patients' confidentiality in states like Massachusetts in this example, or are we really just falling back on a kind of puritanical understanding of sexuality where an STD really is so much more worrisome than any of the other diseases that we might be passing on to each other? You and Greg.
A lot of these diseases can lead to other things like cancer. If you have, you know, herpes or something, that can then actually lead to like cervical cancer.
HPV.
HPV. Herpes can too. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, and so actually it's more than just like the disease. It's really like, wow, these things can lead to other things and they can cost society a lot of money and mm-hmm. they can really destroy a person's whole life.
Right. Now, the statistics on herpes and some of these other HPV in terms of their prevalence are pretty staggering, and somebody could probably cough one of these up. But there is so much prevalence. If you took all of it together, chlamydia, herpes, genital warts, HPV, if you took it all together, warning individual partners of people that have actually been diagnosed might be argued, I'm just devil's advocate here, might be argued to be such a drop in the bucket that maybe revealing to these, you know, five people that I have it and you've had relationships with, you know, sexual intercourse or relations with me may not be as effective as broadcasting to everybody that everybody ought to take precautions yeah. when they're having sexual relationships. In other words, if the true impulse was to protect the society, the good of the public from STDs, then is revealing that I've got one the best interest of everyone, or is it just to assume that the people that you're having sex with are actually potential carriers of the disease and of diseases, and that you need to decide what kind of action you're going to take to protect yourself? I guess that's what I'm asking. It seems to me now of such a level of prevalence that are we really doing this service for the public when we reveal information, given the kind of harms that can come to the patients when that confidentiality is revealed? Or should we really just be talking about broad public health messages? Now, clearly, if in this district they aren't revealing it, they've already made their decision about whether my confidentiality ought to be sacrificed for the good of the public, and they're going this other route. Whereas in Massachusetts, if that's still the rule, they've decided, no, picking out individual people is a good public health strategy.
Well, you said something bit back about whether we're being judgmental and puritanical by picking out sexually transmitted diseases, and that certainly might be a carryover from, you know, previous times where say, from the 50s on back, where it wasn't acceptable to be sexually active and outside of marriage, and now it is. I mean, how much more harm is caused by someone spreading the flu or a particularly horrifying bronchitis or some other very
tuberculosis
transmittable. Well, that's reportable too, but it's not got this stigma.
But if you got if I got tuberculosis, do they?
Yes, they follow you, and they stand there and they watch you take your pills.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But do they call everybody that was in contact with me with tuberculosis?
There was like a guy who like somehow was like on.
Yeah, I know. And they did. They went back to the plane manifesto
because they
right.
It was pretty much eradicated.
Right, in drug-resistant form. Okay, so yes, I think one question we have to ask is, do we pick and choose which diseases we're going to reveal confidentiality for, and are we completely consistent with it? The fact that we never revealed HIV partners, but we did reveal other STDs, information about STDs, already shows that there is some cherry-picking here about what we do and do not disclose. So one of the questions I think we need to ask if we're going to rehabilitate the concept of confidentiality and protect it is what kind of lines should be drawn? Certainly on diseases like tuberculosis, meningitis, nobody cares that you're violating their confidentiality. They want you to. They're interested in that. But on the other diseases where people really don't, I think there is at least an argument to be made that, look, you had sex with me without a condom. Did you think that there was no risk? Because basically, maybe if you put yourself in that position, again, outside of this interspousal thing where you couldn't possibly make that assumption. But outside of that, we met at a bar. I went home with you. You didn't use a condom. Well, what were you thinking? Did you think that... What does it mean? That's so prevalent. Why does my confidentiality get violated when you're the one who acted the way you did and took your own risk? That would be the argument. I know you want to get in first and then two and three.
I think that the idea of like the innocent bystander is huge here, but with the drop in the bucket argument that you bring up, I think it kind of changes the framework and it's no longer individual good versus like public good, but it's more so like the good of one individual or the, you know, kind of bad news for one individual versus the good for five individuals. And it isn't necessarily, like, the public as a whole.
You mean, so on five successive Saturday nights, I had sex with five different people, and I've got gonorrhea, so we're going to tell all those five, women or men, whoever I was with, that they had sex with me and I have gonorrhea, so it's good for those.
So I don't know, right? So I don't know if by notifying individuals or partners of one person, if it's so much for the public good as it's for, you know, a lesser subset.
No, definitely the public here are particular people. It's not just writ large. You're the public. It's true. Even if you narrow it down to Autumn versus five, so one versus five. The question that I think we probably at least need to ask is, did those five people really didn't understand that they were taking some risk when the information is sort of out there that if you have unprotected sex, you put yourself at risk for an STD?
But that presupposes that someone who assumes the risk isn't entitled to the same protection as someone who does not. Just because I'm stupid and engage in risky behavior doesn't mean I don't deserve to be notified and then have the ability to be treated.
Well, I guess the question would be, when you are, it is true, it's a conflict between your needs and mine. You can still be treated, you just have to be symptomatic first. Or
And then what about the people who further, you know, your interspousal or whatever. This is how disease spreads because we have this veil of silence over things like STDs because mm-hmm. we have shame associated with sexual behavior. So I don't know. You can be stupid and ill-informed, but and take a risk, but for the good of the group of society as a whole, you need to be treated and. So,
Or we need just to do a broad public health campaign that says, we're not going to tell you when somebody that you, so we could look at it, we could approach it different, we could say, we're not going to tell you anymore when somebody that you have had sexual relations with has an STD. So you need to take it upon yourself to A, decide the risk you're taking, protect yourself from it, and have, consistent health care exams to make sure that you are healthy. So we could actually go about it the other way. We could just throw our hands up and say, like we did with HIV, we're not going to tell you, but here's what we are going to tell you. There's a lot of sexually transmitted disease out there. Here's how you prevent them, and here's how you get checkups to make sure that you don't have one. So we could make a different choice, and it sounds like, if you're right, on some of these diseases in Philadelphia, that there has already been. And certainly, of the cases I know of friends or acquaintances I've known who have had STDs recently, there hasn't been any reporting here. Mm-hmm. So that means that...
I worked for the public health department. We didn't call people. I did in California when I worked.
Well, that's the same thing as you're saying in Massachusetts. So it is going to be interesting, and we'll move on. But what we're talking about here is this weighing and balancing of interests, and it looks like different jurisdictions are weighing and balancing these different things in different ways. I do think when it comes to the morally, I'm not sure in terms of the public health, but morally, there might be you might feel more pull when it comes to a relationship where the boundaries were supposed to be set in a certain way, and now one person has done something that's violated what that commitment is. Whereas if this was a marriage that was open, and then it seems to me, well, basically that's what it means, that you have to continue to protect yourself.
Well, just when it comes to sex, I think it's difficult because I think, like a lot of people, especially when they're young, they might lie about it, even if they know about it. Even if someone goes to the,
Well, that's another factor we didn't even talk about.
And they say, hey, is there any possibility, or have you been checked up recently? Oh, sure. And oh, please, right. You got to trust me. You got to trust me. I mean, there's all kinds of things like that involved. Right. So there's knowledge out there. Somebody knows. Healthcare people know, and some people might actually be like convinced to go against their better judgment.
Right. Well, and that works the same way with disclosure. So you're the physician, or nurse, and you say to me, "So Autumn, tell me the anybody you've had unprotected sex with," and I could just lie. I mean, I don't have to. I mean, how are you gonna? If I give you that information and you're in a jurisdiction that does reporting, maybe you can go call them, but you can't call anybody that I don't tell you about. So again, it does feel to me like it on the surface, it looks like it's got everything worked out in this public-private dichotomy, but really there's a lot of holes in it. And so we can be thinking about that. In terms of this greater good of preventing infections, I think that the idea that that one person can infect another person can infect another person is a compelling argument, except that up against something like the flu, it's probably quite a weak argument, where one person can infect a lot of people with the flu, and then those people can infect a lot of people with the flu.
So you can infect people on the flu just by, like, touching your hand.
Yeah, just by opening the doorknob.
Opening the doorknob.
Right, exactly.
So it's like,
right.
But they're trying to demonize, not demonize, the whole argument over whether should healthcare workers be mandated to be vaccinated.
Yes, exactly.
Where does the healthcare workers' right to not be exposed to that risk? Because there is a risk.
Right, exactly. No, I think that it is. It's not on confidentiality, but is a dichotomy that's fairly similar. It is actually not for the healthcare provider's benefit that they are doing this, because the healthcare provider could simply say, I assume that risk. I'll just take my 2 weeks in bed and not get the flu shot. This is clearly a sacrifice of the individual's interest for the good of the public interest. So we're going to see this quite a bit. And in this one, I think, as in all others, there are really going to be good arguments on both sides about whether there really is a compelling enough argument that the public good is strong, that the interest of the public is strong enough and consistent enough. For example, I think that most people think that the meningitis case is a fairly slam dunk. It's a life-threatening illness. It has no shame attached. So there doesn't seem to be any downside for the private individual and a whole lot of upside for people who get the prophylaxis. But some of the other cases seem to be more gray, and especially when you get down into something like flu compared to STDs. Okay, so that's the first dichotomy of why he says it's decrepit. And it seems to me that on balance, there seems to be some good arguments, some examples where the public good clearly wins out over the private good, and some where there's debate, at least, that could be had. Okay, the second argument is that my confidentiality sometimes has to be breached because of two interests that I hold. I hold an interest in protecting privacy, my own, and I hold an interest in getting the best care. And this is one of the arguments that you led with, where you said, the reason that so many people need access to my chart is that I have to get care from a whole variety of specialists and folks in different disciplines. And so while I care about keeping my information confidential, I also care about getting the best care. So instead of it being the individual versus the public, it's one interest of an individual versus another interest of the individual. But I think, again, like with the first dichotomy, we sometimes let this dichotomy stand without questioning it. Just like we say, well, of course, sometimes the individual has to sacrifice privacy for the public good. We say that very easily, but in examination we see maybe we go too far sometimes, or maybe there's good arguments about not betraying confidentiality, or maybe we do it too often, too easy. I want to ask, is that similar in the case of saying that Autumn's information has to be spread far and wide in order for Autumn to get the best care? Because that's his argument. Let's pick out as a test case for whether sometimes this distinction doesn't hold as profoundly as Ziegler thinks. Let's look at a test case where I want you to give me an example of some kind of disease that would take somebody to an intensive care unit, let's say, and let's think about all of the different participants in someone's care. So give me a disease that would land you in the intensive care unit, and then let's talk about all of the various eyes that would have to be on that chart in order for us to live up to delivering the best care. So let's start with, give me a disease.
Acute respiratory distress syndrome.
Okay, tell me about that disease.
Like collapsed lungs, and you have to be on a ventilator.
Okay, so we want to be on a ventilator.
Yeah.
All right. So, and is this, how do you get this condition?
You could, there's many ways.
Give me one, because we have to narrow it down so we can pick out our specialists.
You can get pneumonia from having pneumonia.
All right. Let's say we've got pneumonia and a collapsed lung. All right, now I want you to give me all of the different specialists, all of the different disciplines that will be involved in my HIC care.
Do you want to start pre-hospital?
I'm just going to, because one of the things that Ziegler wants to do is see, once you get out of the hospital, is there a way for information to be protected? But I just want, we're in the ICU, how many people, to deliver for me the best care, have to be part of my care? So first, just give me who's going to have to be involved in my care specialist-wise, interdisciplinary specialist.
Pulmonologist.
All right, so you're going to need a pulmonologist.
First, you'll need an attending or intensivist.
You'll need an intensivist. Good.
They may be the same person.
Yeah, sometimes pulmonary critical care goes together. Okay, what else?
Nurses.
What kind of nurse?
ICU nurse.
All right, so you're going to need the ICU nurse who's in charge of me for that, you know, particular rotation, so the 12-hour day and then the next 12-hour day, and, you know.
The charge nurse also.
All right, good. Charge nurse. What else?
The patient care technician or
what's
assistant.
That?
So like nurse's aide.
Nurse's aide. Good. What else?
The ward clerk.
Why does the ward clerk have to know me?
Because sometimes they have to put the orders in the computer.
Okay.
Sometimes they have to make the telephone calls to the specialists.
Okay. Give me some more specialists.
You might have kidney failure too. So
nephrologist.
Infectious disease specialist.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, ID. What else?
Radiologist.
Okay, radiologist.
And the radiology techs.
And the techs.
How about the residents and students?
We'll get to those, because that's where I think the rub comes. Yeah.
What else?
So we have a respiratory therapist.
Right.
Then we might have a phlebotomist, depends on how
yeah,
the hospital is set up. No, not of course.
No?
Well, they also don't always have to know everything.
No, just where I work, we do the blood draws on the patient.
Okay, so...
But sometimes...
Or an IV nurse?
No.
Nope?
No.
That will be an ICU nurse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
But there could be one, so you could leave it.
All right.
It depends on the hospital.
Okay, what else? What is the pharmacist for sure?
Then the pharmacy tech.
Okay. All right. How about nutrition?
Mm-hmm. Well, the dietitian and the dietary department workers are different people.
Okay. All right. How about social worker, chaplaincy?
Well, you have a case mm-hmm. manager and a social worker. And you have the palliative care team, because in my hospital, anybody who's in the ICU gets a palliative okay. care consult.
Okay.
And pastoral care, you probably have to.
Okay.
Now, if you're on the ventilator because somebody violated your living will, you might have the hospital ethics committee.
All right, we'll leave them off for now.
All right.
Okay. Now, it seems to me that Ziegler makes a slam dunk case that for me to get the best care, I need to have a long horizontal list of specialists. People with very different skills, knowledge base that they are bringing to bear, and with few exceptions on this list, there's really nobody that you could dispense with. So, this is where he makes his big claim. But what I want to do is take us to the teaching hospital and ask ourselves, what does this look like in terms of my confidentiality for the at a teaching hospital? So let's start. Not every one of these specialists is going to actually have as many levels as MDs do, but with an MD on the hierarchy, you would have the attending, possibly a fellow depending on the specialist, the resident, the intern if you're talking about the first year, the med student 4, 3, 2, 1, and maybe even the undergrad who's rounding. And in some of these specialists, you'll just have the top of the ticket. You won't have this many distinctions. So you'll have the fully trained nurse, and then you'll have the nursing student somewhere in there. So you won't have as many divisions. Okay. So what I want to do is find out how many on the vertical now we will have, so that we can actually get an assessment of how many people are seeing my personal information when I'm in a course of the ICU. So, start with the pulmonologist, so division of pulmonology, and tell me whether I'm going to have people on the vertical. So how many people in the division, in the discipline of pulmonology, will I have an attending?
It may be determined by the number of people in the group, because you may have a different person rounding every day or a different
right.
person rounding every day.
So in any one of these categories, you could have more than one person. Yes. So just take this as the bare minimum. I'm going to have an attending. Fellow?
Yes.
Yes. Resident?
Yes.
Intern?
Yes.
Medical student?
Yes.
At Penn, you're going to have fourth and third. Are you going to have any second?
Yeah.
Some? Will you have any first?
No.
Okay. How about undergrads? No? Okay.
I mean, you might, like on a random day, you might have a first year or an undergrad shadowing, but...
Shadowing.
Yeah.
All right, then we're going to say possible. Internist. Same vertical? Is there anybody that wouldn't be there? You wouldn't have a fellow, because internal medicine does... Oh, this is an intensivist. Yes. Yeah. All right, so we're definitely going to have the possibility, again, less down in here. Right, we're all in agreement. Okay, that's true. On the ICU nurse, we only have the top of the ticket, and the student, right? Because we don't have that many levels of learning, right? So we'll have the fully trained nurse, and then we'll have a student. How about charge nurse? Will there be a student or a charge nurse is charge nurse?
Sure.
Top of the ticket. Nurse's aide. Just that person, right? Okay. Ward clerk, just that person. Nephrologist, all the way down. Possibly. I mean, less when he gets in here. Okay. Infectious disease, they also have fellows. Would you see residents in infectious disease? Okay, how about medical students? They go, okay? All right, how about...
Well, I think there's a level on this side we skipped.
Which one?
The nurse practitioners that go along with the doctors that are
going okay.
to the top. So, because sometimes yeah. you'll see a nurse practitioner yeah. for every one of those specialties.
Okay, so imagine that you add for every one of these another person for, let's see, nephrologist, radiologist, infection, add those people in. Okay, they're at the vertical because the nurse practitioner, if you're seeing them, they're actually not learning. They're at the top of the ticket. They're at the top of the curve. So, okay, with radiology, you'll certainly see, maybe you'll see fellows depending on what they're doing. You won't really see an intern, right, because they are on medicine for their first year. And will the medical students round with radiology?
Right.
Okay. Rad tech, you'll just see the one that's there. And you'll
no, you might see more.
Say it again?
There might be a bunch of people. Sometimes when you go to do x-rays or whatever, there might be more than just one tech. There
okay.
A couple,
it's usually a couple.
All right. Put three there.
Yeah.
Respiratory therapist. Okay. Phlebotomist. You'll have a student often. Pharmacist. Will you see a pharm student? Pharmacy
yeah.
student?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right? Farm tech, well, they're not, I don't know where to put them, but we'll put them here. We have more than one? No, probably
sometimes,
right?
Sometimes,
sometimes.
Three or four in a day.
Three or four in a day, okay? Again, they're not quite on the hierarchy there. Nutrition, at least one. Dietary worker, there'll be a couple. Case manager, social work, you'll have social work students for sure. At some, right? Palliative care would go all the way down. And pastoral care, you'll often have students. Okay, so. And if this had involved more specialists, if you had given me one that was an oncology bone marrow transplant now on a ventilator, we would have even more disciplines on the hierarchy. Now, here's the thing. Of the specialists that we have up there, of all the green blocks, one question you could ask is, how many of these green blocks are delivering for me are participating in my getting the best care, and how many of the green blocks are actually part of that original dichotomy between the patient and the public good? In other words, when Ziegler makes this claim that Autumn, as the patient, her confidentiality needs to be violated over and over and over and over and over again because otherwise she wouldn't get the best care, one of the questions I have is, does he justify all of those green blocks under the right dichotomy, or is it really the private versus the public good? Does he have the right punchline? Individual patients' confidentiality often has to be breached for some other competing interest. But is he too quick to categorize the teaching hospital and the care that I get under the dichotomy of, well, it's the best thing for Autumn right now, or is the best thing for Autumn actually part of the public good about Autumn in the future? And I think he'd be better off talking about the teaching hospital, at least on some of these blocks, being as being defended, very, I think, convincingly defended on the dichotomy between the individual versus the public good, rather than on the individual's privacy concern and getting the best care. Now, you're going to argue to me, and you should, that there are people on this hierarchy that are actually giving me better care than people higher up. Like you've all heard stories of how there are certain skills that learners have much more in hand than old farts who have been at this for a really long time. Like I said to my OB-GYN, you should take the staples out. I want you to take the staples out after my C-section. And the obstetrician said, believe me, you want a resident to take staples out. I haven't taken staples out in a long time. Anesthesiologists will often say, you want a resident to do the spinal because I'm the one who does stuff much more higher up than that. You don't want me to do that procedure because this is where the dexterity and the facility with those skills is actually paramount. So there are some skills where lower on the hierarchy actually delivers for Autumn the best care. And yet we all know that down in here, the first time something is tried, it certainly isn't the case, and that goes for nursing specialties and medical specialties. So if you have, I remember at this, it was an endoscopy, and it was a student nurse. She stuck me three times. At the third stick, she brought in her boss, who just nailed the thing. I mean, clearly, Autumn didn't get the best care by Autumn's definition of having the student nurse stick me three times, but Autumn, as part of the public, invested in that student nurse someday being the one who stuck me the first time and got it right. Autumn is invested. But then that's not the same hierarchy. That's not the same dichotomy. Go ahead.
I think that's true on a procedural level because, you know, when you're trying to learn how to do procedures. But in terms of on the whole system-wide level, it may not be true because of time constraints. So, I mean, different people in that hierarchy have also not only just different skills, but also a lot more time. So you might get better care with a whole team of people because you get more exposure to any kinds of providers than if there were just attendings.
It would be an interesting question to run a study to find out because it is certainly the lore. It is what we are told, that there's so many people looking after you that if one doesn't see it, the other one will. And so there's got to be some grain of truth to that, and sometimes maybe more than a grain. But one thing that is also true is that for some of these things, you tell your story to one person, you tell it to another, 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 you tell it to another. I remember being pre-op once, and this person came in and said that they wanted to do some kind of exam, and I thought, why don't you just admit what's going on here? Your exam at level here or here isn't going to be any better than the talking to the person up here, but you need this learning, and I'm happy to give it to you, but then just don't tell me that you're doing this for my benefit. Let's just admit that you're doing it not just for your own benefit as you learn, but you're doing it for the investment that we all make in having providers once these people are all dead and retired. So it's not that it can't be justified to have you do three exams exactly the same on me from different people at the level. It's that we sometimes want to couch everything in this dichotomy where a lot of things I think would be better off justified in this one. Because if in fact I sniff out or I start to become suspicious that all of this repetition or sometimes failed attempts to do something or, you know, clearly not having the mastery in hand is justified to me under this dichotomy, I might actually push back and say, really? You're delivering the best care. You stuck me three times. This is not the best care. But if you had said to me, I'm trying to learn so that I can be the professional that you need later, and so I'm hoping that you will allow me to, you know, this isn't what you say, but this is the spirit of it, to that you would participate in your investment in the future of healthcare, then I'd say, you know what, give it another shot. As opposed to selling me on it that you're actually giving me the best care when I know I'm not, sometimes down in here. If you sold it to me as, I'm learning, and so this helps me, but it also ultimately helps us all, I'd say, all right, well, for that investment, it's fine if I'm not getting the absolute best care. So I think that there might be, I think there is something absolutely to what you're saying. I think there's also sometimes we don't always distinguish when that's true, and it clearly is sometimes true, as in some of my examples as well, when it's just clearly not true. It's everybody in year three has to have a certain number of XYZ procedures done to get out of year three. And that isn't anybody getting me more care now. It's actually people getting me and you all of us, better care later. So I think, in summary, on the Ziegler piece, he's got dichotomies that definitely justify not only the violation of confidentiality, but also participation in healthcare where my interest isn't always protected and shouldn't always be. But sometimes I think he's mixed up what his justifications are. Comments, questions, objections? All right. So that is Ziegler's argument about the decrepit concept. He's got some solutions for it, which are, you know, limit to only those who need to know outside of the hospital and, you know, some other things. You can look at them. I'm not sure that any of his solutions really do that much for us. So I want to turn us now to HIPAA and ask, what is it that HIPAA does and what is it that HIPAA cannot do? Tell me what the limits are of, or the parameters of HIPAA. Obviously, if there's a national law, Health Information Protection Act, it is certainly the case in the U.S. that Americans care quite a bit about the privacy of their health care information. So tell me, where does HIPAA end up truly protecting patients, and where does it have the right spirit, maybe, but maybe not deliver on some of its promises? Give me either one. HIPAA's success and HIPAA's failure, or at least shortcomings.
Well, the success in the sense that a practitioner can't go out and talk about patient at all, really. I mean, you can talk about the issues that the patient is going through, but you can't mention any information that will reveal the patient's identity at all if you're talking to any member of the public or anybody like outside the walls of the clinic, and I think it's successful there.
Okay. I think it's definitely successful. That's what it's supposed to do. And I think it's definitely successful in some of the most obvious iterations of it, like I walk out and I say, oh my God, do you know Britney Spears is in there? And guess what? She's got gonorrhea or whatever. I mean, it's in that kind of blatant trying to share information, it probably has reined things in. On the pessimistic side of whether it can really get a hold of this, I'll give you this example to only make the point that if HIPAA is going to be successful, we probably need a deeper analysis and reflection on how we can violate the standards of HIPAA in less blatant ways than my Britney Spears example, and I'll give you an example. I was talking to a plastic surgeon once. Did I give you this example ever? And this person said to him, was talking about, oh, you know, I'm in philosophy. He said, I have a patient with a sarcoma on her toe, no name, so good on HIPAA. And, she's a professor at the such and such university. Guess what? How many women in philosophy are there in the such and such university?
Right.
One. So I now know that this person at the such and such university has a sarcoma on her toe. It's worse than that. I went to undergrad with her. It's not that I'm blaming HIPAA. It's just that I think it's easy to know that you're not revealing patient confidentiality when you actually say Britney Spears has gonorrhea and I just treated her. It isn't always obvious to practitioners, I think, how easily information about patients that they think is not disclosing is actually quite disclosing.
But I've been told, I mean, I've had so many talks in all my different jobs about HIPAA, and they always stress that you are not allowed to do stuff like that. You are not allowed to give any information away that could give away the identity of the person.
Well, then they're doing a better job. Then they really are, I think, doing a better job at helping people understand how information that you think is not disclosing. I'll give you another example. This one clinician said, also finding out that I was in philosophy, a different clinician said, oh, wow, I mean, I actually treated somebody who had moved from this university to that university. One university where I had actually gotten my PhD and another one where everybody lamented that the person had gone from that university to the other university. Again, and it is great that if more attention, now obviously these are two practitioners at very renowned top flight medical schools, two different medical schools. So clearly somebody didn't get the memo that you got, right? Because this was not the backwater of Berwick, Pennsylvania, where I was born. This was top five medical schools. and these were attending. So, okay, good. Lesson learned then. So that's one thing HIPAA is trying to protect. Okay. What does HIPAA isn't able to protect? Can you think about confidentiality violations? Not like this. This isn't violation. Every one of the people, all those green squares, had a legitimate right, even if it's not, in my mind, properly, accurately defended. It should be defended based on the interest in the public good rather than defended all the time on, oh, you're getting really good care because I'm sticking you 20 times. Either way, everyone on that chart had a legitimate access to my record. Can you give me an example of the kind of information that HIPAA does not protect, and yet it isn't so legitimate as what we had on that board? Can you give me some examples where you see information about one patient being heard or given inadvertently or advertently to someone else that is not part of their care?
So I think the ICU is a good example of that, where there's a lot of things going on and a lot of people in one concentrated area, and people are inadvertently hearing one thing or another about the person next to them.
I think that's a great example. I remember rounding when I first got the job because I wasn't exposed to the institution of medicine, so they thought that it was a good idea, and I do too. So I rounded with the intensive care team. And everybody's from different hospitals, but at HUP, the rounds, at least 10 years ago, took place right outside the patient's door.
Still do.
So all kinds of information is being talked about, including psychosocial information and details about the disease. And now that there are patients' family members able to be, being with their loved ones at all hours, you could easily have somebody who's completely unrelated medically on that green chart walk by and hear information.
Or just the other nurses, and nurses talk to each other.
Where they're not even directly involved in that care. Right, exactly. Right, okay, so I think that's a perfect example. Yes, okay, what else? What else can HIPAA, does HIPAA not have the teeth to really protect against? Well, I'll give you an example. I had an elective C-section for my second kid, so they put you in a holding pen at Pensy, which is the baby factory of UPHS. So they put you in a holding cell, basically, and there's somebody else in the holding cell, too. And there's a curtain between one person in a holding cell and the other person in the holding cell. Now, interestingly, it kind of reminds me about the old-time smoking and non-smoking sections. Because I don't know if you remember going to restaurants when there was smoking and non-smoking sections, but it was always amazing to me that restaurants really thought that smoke didn't travel from my non-smoking table to the smoking table next to me. Strange thing about air, it just kind of migrated like that. And it's funny about curtains, because sound and curtains sort of function the same way. So I remember, I think it was a resident, but it doesn't matter, walks into the holding pen and has the person next to me's chart and says, Mrs. So-and-so, and that's Mrs. So-and-so or whatever, and then begins to talk about her preeclampsia and her premature contractions and everything else on the other side of the curtain. So I know all about Mrs. So-and-so. Now, Mrs. So-and-so's not a philosopher, or I would surely know a whole bunch about her because the world is so small, so I don't know Mrs. So-and-so, but I could have. HIPAA doesn't have any teeth for that, because HIPAA says that you must protect confidentiality up to the point where your institution physically, your infrastructure, can accommodate it. So you can't build a new hospital with double rooms, but the double rooms that already exist, HIPAA doesn't make you renovate. And the holding pens that you divide with curtains, they don't make you build walls. So there is information that, despite everybody's best effort just in trying to treat all the different people with the infrastructure that's there, HIPAA doesn't do a whole lot. And it's the same thing in some of, I remember it being in a doctor's office and the door was open, and I was amazed that the physician was talking about this issue without the door closed. Because I thought, you know, any number of people could walk by and hear this information. So there are, I think, still some things where HIPAA doesn't have teeth. But in general, it was designed to try to protect information that should not be shared. Okay. There's a lot of criticism about KIPP. Well, let's end on that, and then we'll move on to Tarasov. What are the kind of criticisms that you often hear from the provider perspective? I've given you some where, from the patient perspective, where it doesn't look like HIPAA may go far enough to protect information, maybe through its own fault or maybe not. What about from the provider perspective? How has HIPAA been received?
What do you think?
A bureaucratic nightmare?
There is, I mean, well, I don't know why you're the only person speaking up. It's practically universally bitched at, you know, bitched about. I mean, everybody talks about the burden of HIPAA and signing the form and the cumbersomeness, and you got to write for records and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be difficult if you're a physician at, you know, one hospital or institution, and your patient is at another institution.
Right.
And you can't even talk to that other provider without consent from the patient.
Right.
And that can be difficult just in approaching the patient's care.
Right, exactly. So there's, and then there's the whole paperwork, the stream of paperwork. Every time you go to a new doctor, you're signing forms, and you're hoping that in the end of the day, there's more that you're getting from it than the inefficiencies and the cost and the bureaucracy that come out of it.
But there are other protections built into it. I mean, that don't have that much to do with confidentiality. Part of it is different hospitals would dump patients that were a problem without insurance. They would just move them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that anymore.
Because of HIPAA?
Because of HIPAA.
Which part of it?
There's a part in there that you cannot be transferred to another hospital without your consent.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And there was some stuff built in, I think, about COBRA as well, which they can't, they have to, if you're terminated, they have, or you choose to leave your job, you're allowed to continue your health benefits. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some other parts to it that aren't horrible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of paperwork involved in them, but there's not so much dumping.
Well, that's certainly good for the one who would have been dumped. All right, and let's move on now so to the last topic for the night, which is Tarasoft. Okay, this was the most famous court case that dealt with confidentiality and one of the first in the medical arena of its kind. Give me the backdrop of what was at issue in the Tarasoft case. It's a 1976 decision of a 1969 event. So it often takes a very long time for decisions, for appeals to work their way through. This was a California Supreme Court decision, though it had repercussions, as we talked about with Quinlan and Bouvet and Wendland. They were all state cases. It still had reverberations all across the country. And it really is the standard now in terms of this duty and when confidentiality is supposed to be breached. What did Tarasoff? Give me first the facts of the case. What happened in the? What's the scenario that got us to a legal case, to a court case? Mm-hmm.
A man became obsessed with a woman who did not return the feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Confided to a psychologist that he had a plan to kill her. The psychologist reported him to the campus police. It was a college event. The police decided that he really wasn't a threat and released him. And the supervising psychiatrist ordered all of the paperwork around it to be destroyed. The man went on to kill the girl, and then her parents sued because
right.
of the duty to inform and duty to protect this girl from a known threat.
Right. So the question here was what was at issue in the law school was in the lawsuit was the failure to detain and the failure to warn. So what wasn't at issue was the psychologist reporting that he thought that Tarasoff is the woman's name. I forget the guy's name. But that, what's his name?
Podar?
Podar, something like that, yeah. That he thought the man was a threat. And that's why he reported it to the police. So this was actually not a case about should he have reported to the police. everybody thought, he thought he should report it to the police. The reason that he got sued and the regents got sued, so the University of California got sued, was because nobody took the next step of actually finding Tatiana Tarasoff and warning her. So it wasn't about whether this man's confidentiality should be breached because he was understood to be a credible threat. Everybody agreed that that's what should have happened. But then the question was, is there an obligation to go even further than that, namely to retain him after you've warned him? And more importantly, for the way that the law played out in terms of other states and jurisdictions, was there an obligation to actually warn a specific third party that she was in imminent danger? Okay, so what was the reasoning behind the majority opinion? That the majority opinion was it was in agreement with the Tarasoff family that the professionals didn't do what they were supposed to do. What was their what was the verdict from the majority opinion?
Something to do with not notifying the non-campus police, like the city police or something?
I don't know if it mattered who got informed. What was critical was that that not enough was done to retain him, and nothing was done by whomever to warn her. So the issue wasn't whether the psychologist should have warned Tatiana Tarasoff, or whether the campus police should have warned Tarasoff, or whether the actual city police should have warned her. The lawsuit was somebody had to warn her, that there was a legal obligation to warn her. Now, what did they put parameters around that? What kind of a bar does a therapist or a psychiatrist have to meet in order to have the obligation to go warn? What are the restrictions on it? Do you warn anytime, anyone, for any reason? This court case put pretty strict parameters on when that obligation comes into play.
Is it when you're in danger to yourself or
so that's others? Already true. If you're in danger to yourself or somebody else, but when do you have the duty to warn that person as opposed to the duty to report? That's different. When do you all have the duty to come to me somehow, not necessarily directly? You know, they're not asking therapists to go and be detectives, but to get it to get me warned. Under what circumstances must you have it be the case that I am warned? What has to be true of what the situation is? What is it?
I was saying you have evidence.
What kind of evidence? It's true. You have to have a certain kind of evidence.
A verbalized threat.
Okay, and that threat has to be against
a specific person.
A very specific person. Right. So if, for example, I come in and I say, I'm going and I'm just going to bomb anybody I can see, no, you may have a duty to report if you think, and we'll talk about when you do, but you only have a duty to warn when it's a very specific threat that you think is credible. If you don't think it's credible, you're not liable under Tarasoff. If people who have your same kind of training would also agree you could never have seen that coming. So, for example, if I say, oh my gosh, Paul went on a business trip during the hurricane, I am going to kill him for this. Do you think I mean that? Right? You know. So you're not going to go warn Paul, oh my God, she's going to kill you, because you don't believe it. And none of you actually believed it. You do, because you're ready to kill yours too. But, you know, in general, nobody believed me. If your peers in your level of profession, psychiatrists or psychologists, if nobody would believe that threat, you're not obligated. It's when your peers would say, I don't know, sounds like it was a credible threat. I mean, he said, I'm going to kill her with a knife. I'm going to dig her heart out. I'm going to hunt her down like a dog, that whore. And you are starting to get this a very different vibe from me talking like that than when I said I'm going to kill my husband for going to Minnesota that day. So if you seem to be falling down on the job, seem to be shirking responsibility, seem to be really not at the top of your game there as a therapist or a psychiatrist, and others would have seen what you didn't see, then maybe you are liable. You're certainly not liable if you and your peers don't think there's a credible threat. So that's one of the things that they said. It has to be a specific person, and it has to be a threat that your peers think is also a credible threat. Then there is a duty to warn. Okay, what else? What are the kind of arguments that people would make against the Tarasoff decision? And how does the majority opinion defend against those criticisms? What would be the reason why you would worry about having that be the law?
Well, especially in psychiatric situations, the confidentiality, I mean, people have to feel free to express fears and fantasies, and that's part of the process of working through your problems is to kind of go to the bad place and get pulled back. So
okay.
That people would then not fully participate in their care and not,
all right,
not be well.
Okay. So if you are going to try to heal me from whatever rage I have, such that I am planning to kill Tatiana Tarasoff, how, if that's possible at all, how will you achieve that if I don't tell you the truth about what I'm thinking and feeling and planning to do? So if you make it impossible for me to tell you the truth, because then you're going to retain me and talk about me and violate my trust with you, then why will I share it with you in the first place? So one concern is, it from the minority opinion, was it will undermine therapy's ability to heal and to actually help people. So that's one thing. What else is the concern about patients knowing that this is the law now, that my confidentiality can be breached in this way? What are the other implications about me and my relationship to therapy? One is I won't share once I get there. What else does the minority opinion worry about?
You wouldn't go at all.
I won't go at all. So basically, now you've got all the killers running around, and instead of seeking help, they won't seek help at all. They'll just stay with their murderous thoughts, and you won't have any chance of finding some way to heal or to create some kind of resolution for me and treat me in the way that I need to be treated. Because I just won't go at all. So if I go, I'll lie, mostly I just won't go. Okay. What else in terms of the warning problem? If you go and you warn the patient, why will the minority opinion worry about that act? What is the moral concern of the minority opinion if it does become the case that you go and you start warning other people about me? Mm-hmm. It's not related to therapy. Yeah.
Then everyone will know.
I mean, yeah, are you going to go and violate? How many times are you going to go around and to how many people are you going to tell that I've got murderous impulses? So doesn't it violate my liberty that every time you have the least concern about something I say, you're going to go and blab it to all, to the various people? Now, of course, the majority says back that this isn't going to happen very often, because it isn't very often that a therapist actually has a named victim and that therapist believes it is a credible threat. But certainly one of the things that the minority opinion worried about was the breach of my privacy at going rampant, that it would really undermine the idea of the doctor-patient confidentiality. It would just destroy it with you telling everybody what I what is in the dark places of my heart. Okay. Let's see. What else? Any other? Another thing that the case decided was that you had an obligation to take reasonable care, what is reasonably necessary. But it didn't mean that, again, that you had to go out and try to hunt that person down and that person had moved and you got to try to find that person's other address. You can just hand that over as a as a professional to the police, and then it is really their obligation to go and do all of that hunting down of that person to warn them. All right? What any other concerns on either side?
Well, I thought it was interesting in the Nari piece, it talked about how they had released almost 1,000 committed people that were committed as a danger. They had to be released in California for, I don't remember why, and they followed up a year later, and only 7 out of the 1,000 had actually committed any kind of violent act at all. It was that the psychiatrist or psychologist didn't really have a good handle on who is a threat to themselves or others. Mm-hmm. They weren't a good judge of who truly should be committed to.
And you can see why in the aftermath of a verdict like this, you would err on the side of, well, I don't know, but I think we better retain you anyway, because you don't want to be on the side of getting your butt thrown in jail because you underreacted. So it has this propensity to overreact and take threats more seriously than you might have if this obligation hadn't been on you. All right. Any other concerns, any other questions or comments or thoughts about the Tarasoff decision? So lots of laws followed suit, and you saw the paper where they followed them up and they looked at the permutations. Still one of the most, as I said, famous cases on confidentiality. Okay, well, then I think we are done. I won't see you next week, and when I see you again, you'll bring your laptops and you'll have your paper.